Difficult to follow all the amazing presentations that you've had this morning, so I don't in any way expect to kind of touch on the power that people have already spoken about, and it's really, really incredible. So just, I think a lot of what I'm going to say has probably already been said, but what I wanted to do was to look at, have we really liked or being fearful of young people through the generations anyway? You know, when we're thinking about participation, it's as though it's an open and easy door, but actually a lot of the prejudices and difficulties in terms of adult-child relationships kind of historically embedded. And is there a distinction between the deserving and the undeserving participant? There's been a lot of that coming up this morning all the way through, but what's that embedded in terms of the history and how that influences who, as adults, approach to participate? And how has the history of child sexual exploitation impacted on all of this? So a lot of what I'm going to just brush through now has already been talked about and probably far more meaningfully and powerfully and eloquently than I'm going to do. But those were the sorts of things that I thought might be helpful to touch on. So have we liked young people? Sometimes I have myself or have been with people or heard people, adults, say, walking down the street, see a group of young people coming towards you, what do? You cross over to the other side of the street. And what the hell is all that about? It's about the fact that often a group of young adolescents or older adolescents touches into us what we were probably afraid of during our adolescence, if not before. And that it's a mirror. So how we resolved our own adolescence probably impacts on how we see other young people, because are they reflecting to us what we never really resolved for ourselves? Issues about sex, issues about drugs, issues about rebellion, all those sorts of things. Maybe seeing young people kind of touches into us what was there for us in our adolescence. And so there is this real big thing, I think, that we've got to do some work on ourselves before we start really asking children and young people to come and tell us what to do. We need to make sure that we're comfortable with ourselves in terms of how we felt about our own adolescence. And what just one of my favourite pieces of work was a book written by Geoffrey Pearson called Demonised Youth Hooligan, A History of Respectable Fears. And what he does is he goes right the way back, and says, you know, come on, this is not a new phenomenon. This discussion we've been having about the media, where it's, you know, a new thing, a new fantastic new story about this new problem with children and young people, it's gone on for years. And what he does particularly is look at the Victorian era, where people were afraid of adolescents and tried to control them. The whole different sort of periods of punk, mods and rockers, God knows what, you know, all the way through, where we just demonise groups of children and young people. And why do we do that? Is it because actually in ourselves we still have unresolved adolescent feelings as adults? So, you know, what's going on there? Are we confused by children and young people? So inside all of the adolescent, there's the child and the adult. Inside us as adults, are all of those issues resolved? So when we see children and young people, do we feel that actually we're talking to a young person who is going to try to challenge us, try to work with us? Are we able to take the rebellion that maybe a lot of children and young people are presenting us with? Have we worked out how we feel about that ourselves? I don't know whether we, the adult community, sitting in a chair thinking, I'm going to open my door to young people to participate, really take on board what it means for them. And I think there's work that we need to do in that. And we use young people. You know, in what sort of situations do we think about recognising the hypocrisy of us saying to children and young people that they shouldn't, you know, developing your sexuality, developing how you feel about using your body either as a sexual object or not is straightforward, when within the whole commercialization of sex and sexual orientation and sexual beings, we've got an industry We've got an industry that sells things through sex, through children. And I really remember interviewing a young person who quite rightfully got really livid with me. It's a young man. And he said to me, "Why are you asking me these questions? You should be asking those internet providers, those companies that are selling stuff. You know, forget about me. You're asking the wrong person." And so I think that's for me has been a really important lesson. The deserving and undeserving participant. Up until 2009, children and young people could be arrested for soliciting offences or offences related to soliciting. And Lucy's very nice about saying it's just a couple of years. But I remember in the mid-1980s working in a police station, going out with police at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, bringing children and young people back into the police station and trying to talk to the police about why it was not a good idea to arrest this child for soliciting. 13, 14, 15-year-olds going through the courts, being arrested for soliciting, for selling sex. And the language was very much there up until really 2009, when it was safeguarding rather than children involved in prostitution. Have we really got away from that? We're very much, I mean, what Camille was talking about earlier in terms of progression, you know, we have got much better at not using that language, but some of the assumptions underneath, I think perhaps we have to really hold on to remember. So the way I think it gets played out, which I know has been said already this morning, is, you know, if we've got a nice passive victim, usually white, usually a girl, saying, "I don't want this to happen to me," then we jump in and we rescue, and they are a victim. But if we've got a young person who is rightfully angry and rightfully saying, "I've got rights to do what I want to do under this impossible circumstance, and I'm going to do it," are we going to ask those young people to participate with us in developing policies and practice? I don't know. And so the victims of sexual offences might be perceived as more deserving. But when we take that undeserving and deserving sort of concept together, it is embedded in the UN, the rights of the child discussion. So we've got Article 19 that says that we've got a right to participate for protection from abuse, and there are other articles that Gerrison here does all of this work far more than I do. But we also have rights, that children have the right to freedom to expression. How do we balance that in reality when we're talking and working with children and young people who say, "I have the right to use my body in whatever way I want, whether I want to use drugs or whether I want to stay with this person because at the moment that's a better option for me than elsewhere," rather than somebody who's saying, "Please come and help me, please come and take me out of this situation." Are we really engaging with balancing that, those, all children and young people's rights to have their voice coming forward? And I'm not in any way saying that we should condone or go along with abuse. I'm not saying that. But I do think we have the responsibility to listen to all of those children and young people's voices. So are we really reaching out? And are we asking all CSE-affected young people to participate rather than just those who, as we've been talking about this morning, see themselves as, or may be seen as, sort of passive victims? And I suppose what I wanted to finish with, really, was thinking about how do we make sure that that history, you know, me in the police station trying to work with the police to prevent them from arresting the children. I have still recently heard, and I think it's a real problem for us, the use of secure units, the use of secure accommodation, somewhere to keep children safe, being seen as the best option, when actually the child or young person doesn't want that. But in order to protect them, there seems to be no other alternative. How do we work with that? How do we make sure that those sorts of really complicated issues are brought into our developing policy and practice?
Thank you.